the divine souls. Yesterday, we learned about the avatar rahasya told by Sri Krishna in the fourth chapter of the Gita. So there we learned that God never incarnates. He takes avatar. He descends or he appears. He's not born in the same way we are. Although we say he takes janma, but his janma is very different than ours. He's not born in a material way. He simply appears in this world. And it so follows that he doesn't die. His body doesn't die. He simply disappears from the world. And he's always omnipresent. There were a couple of very important verses that I left out from the fourth chapter, which are they contain such an important devotional philosophy that in fact we could do a whole series on each of them. So one of them is Ye yatha mam prapadyante tas tathaiva bhajamyaham. A simple statement with a very deep meaning, like many verses in the Gita. Sri Krishna says, however a soul surrenders to me, I grace him accordingly. This has two main meanings. Both of them will take some time to understand. One meaning is that it is Sri Krishna who comes to everybody, meaning anyone who gets God realized in this entire world, no matter what religion they belong to, no matter what country or culture they belong to, or anywhere in this universe, no matter what earth planet they live on, Sri Krishna says, I come. I'm the one whose grace everybody receives. But they receive it in the form that they desired. According to what form they worshipped me in, I come to them in that form. That's what it means. That if someone is worshipping any form of God, they're not worshipping someone else. They're worshipping Sri Krishna in that form. It is He who comes in that form. There's more detail on this in the Bhagavatam. Same Vedavyas who wrote the Gita also wrote the 18 Puranas. In the very last, after writing Vedas, Puranas, Mahabharata, Gita, Brahma Sutra, all of that, after doing all of that, Vedavyas wrote the Bhagavatam last. So it's said to be his final and in fact most important and authoritative work. He reconciled all the philosophies into the Bhagavatam in a very, very neat way. Just took all the philosophies and brought them all together. For instance, talking about the various forms of God, he says, Vadanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yajjnanam advayam Brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdyate. Supreme God has three main forms that are not separate, they're abhinna. They're just three ways in which He appears. Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahma. Three words we use. Brahma means formless God. Paramatma means Almighty God. And Bhagavan means the loving form of God. So, are these three synonymous? Meaning, just like we say, Pani, Toy, Jal, three different words for the same thing. It all means water. No. They're not synonymous like that. It's more like Pani, Barf, Bhap. See the difference? It's the same thing substantially, but in three different ways. Water can also be ice and can also be vapor or steam. Substantially, it's the same thing. There's no difference in the makeup, the chemical makeup of the substance. It's exactly the same in all three forms, whether it's in vapor form, liquid form, or solid form as ice or snow. So internally, you can say it's the same thing, but externally, it has different uses. On a cold day, if you want a hot drink to warm up, and you say, bring me some boiling water so I can drink that and feel warm, and someone brings you ice cubes, you'll say, I asked you for hot water, and the person says, what's the difference? It's all H2O. I brought you H2O. So it doesn't work that way. Practically, they have different uses. In somewhat the same way, Brahma, Paramatma, and Bhagwan are internally one, but have different, that can be experienced differently by souls and appear differently. Brahma is formless. Paramatma has a form, an almighty form. And Bhagwan has a form and does one thing that Paramatma doesn't do. Leelas. Loving, playful leelas. Why the difference? Simply the powers, the manifestation of the powers. In each form, whether it's Brahma, Paramatma, or Bhagwan, God has unlimited powers, so all the unlimited powers are there in each of those three, but not necessarily revealed outwardly. So Brahma is Alpavyakta Shaktik Brahma. Shaktik meaning having powers. Alpa vyakt. Vyakt means outwardly manifested. Alpa vyakt means just very little power is outwardly manifested. All the other powers in Brahm remain dormant. It doesn't mean those powers aren't there. They are there, but they're dormant. Like when you sleep, you may be tested and score, 160 on an IQ test, top of the charts. But when you're sleeping, you can't be said to be intelligent. Your power of knowledge is dormant because your mind is sleeping. So does that mean you lost your power? No. Your power is still there, but it's just not active. So in Brahm, very few powers are active. Just to maintain its existence, you can say. But because no other powers are active, Brahma has no form. And in fact, can't be experienced. I'll explain why when I go forward. Compare this to Paramatma. Paramatma has more of the powers manifested. Therefore, Paramatma has a form, Almighty God. So, just saying Almighty God who has a form is still very vague. In other religions, they also say, oh, there's a God. And they may say God is formless. Or they may say God has a form. But they don't go beyond that as far as giving a definite description of what that form is. Our Vedic scriptures are the only place where we have the actual precise description of what Almighty God looks like. He is Vishnu. He is Shiva. She is Durga. These are the three main forms, and then they each have many affiliates. Not other gods, just their own affiliated powers, like Lakshmi, Parvati, Saraswati, Ganeshji, Kartikeya. These are all affiliate forms of Vishnu, Shiva, and Durga. So these are forms of Almighty God, or you can say forms of the Almighty Power. So why does God have a form? Because his powers are manifested. Those powers were dormant in Nirakar Brahm. Therefore, Nirakar Brahm is Nirakar. No form. No manifested form. So Nirakar Brahm doesn't do anything. Just like you when you're sleeping. What do? Nothing. You're inactive. Like you're resting. Similarly, Nirakar Brahm doesn't do anything. Who creates the universe? Almighty God, Paramatma, creates the universe. Who maintains and upholds the existence of the universe? Paramatma does, Almighty God. Nirakar Brahm doesn't do any such work. Nirakar Brahm is an inactive existence, just a divine energy, divine truth. Doesn't do anything. Doesn't keep track of what the souls are thinking or doing. Who does that? Paramatma. Doesn't grace the souls to be alive. No. Who does that? Paramatma, Almighty God. So when God's powers are active, then God has a form and God performs actions. He does things. For us, not for himself, but nonetheless, he does things. Nirakar Brahm cannot grace anybody. When we talk about God realization and we say that to get God realized, you have to get God's grace. You can't do it on your own. Or even to be liberated from Maya, it is only possible through God's grace. So can you get that grace from Nirakar Brahm? If you surrender to Nirakar Brahm, you meditate on and worship Nirakar Brahm, will you get the grace? No. Why not, you'll say? It's the same Vishnu, it's the same Shiva, same Durga who's just formless. It's not a separate God, like one God is formless, one God is almighty. No, it's the same God, just a formless aspect. So you'll say then, why can't formless God grace me? It's like saying, why can't I drink ice cubes and feel hot? It's the same as hot water, it's H2O. Yes, but it has different uses, it has different characteristics manifested in those different forms. So you can't demand heat from an ice cube, and you can't demand to be cooled down by drinking boiling hot water. The two have their own separate characteristics. Similarly, formless God has his own characteristics. In fact, you could say, all of his characteristics are unmanifested. That's why he's nirguna nirakar, nirvishesh. There's no defining characteristics because all of his powers are dormant. No qualities are manifested. No power is outwardly manifested. So this is formless God. The same God is almighty. And when he's manifesting some of his power, he appears as Almighty God in any of those forms, almighty forms. But there's one thing that Almighty God doesn't do, that is loving leelas. So Bhagawan, who manifests the power of divine love, does leelas. So we have two main leela avatars. Krishna and Ram. They are the two who came on the earth planet for the specific purpose of doing leelas that would then be recorded by great saints in the Ramayana, Mahabharata, Bhagavatam, etc. and then used by the souls as a means of doing devotion by learning about and meditating on those leelas. So leela avatar are Ram and Krishna. So in this definition of Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahm, Ram and Krishna are referred to with the term Bhagavan, and Vishnu, Shiva, Durga, or any of the other almighty forms of God, they're referred to as Paramatma. Although in casual conversation, we use the terms interchangeably. If someone asked you, who is Paramatma, you could say Krishna is Paramatma, Ram is Paramatma, Shiva is Paramatma, Vishnu is Paramatma. We don't just say Bhagwan Shri Krishna or Bhagwan Ram. We also say Bhagwan Vishnu, Bhagwan Shiva, Bhagavati Durga. So in our talking, we use these terms interchangeably. But in this verse where Vedavyas is describing the difference in the powers of God and what is manifested or what isn't, he's saying Krishna and Ram are Bhagawan in this case. Paramatma is all the almighty forms of God, and formless God is Nirakar. So in what form are all of the powers fully manifested? In Ram, there's one power that's a little bit restricted. That's the power of Prem, the divine love power, God's most personal and intimate power, which is not revealed at all in Paramatma, in the almighty forms of God. It is revealed moderately in Ram, but not in full. It is revealed in full in the form of Shri Krishna. So if you were to ask the question, you know, we say there's only one God who appears in all the forms. So who is that God who appears in all the forms? You only have to ask, if all of God's powers are fully manifested, in what form is he appearing? Shri Krishna. So if you want to get really technical about it, it is Shri Krishna who appears as all the other forms. If all of his powers are manifested, he's in his loving form with the peacock feather and the flute, Shri Krishna of Vrindavan and Golok. If just that divine love power is slightly restricted, he appears as Ram. The same Krishna is Ram. No difference. If the divine love power is fully restricted, so he's only almighty, then the same Shri Krishna appears as Vishnu or Shiva or any other form. And the same Shri Krishna, if all of his powers are dormant, he is formless. But he doesn't change back and forth. It's not like one minute he's Shri Krishna, the next minute he becomes Ram, the next minute he's formless. He doesn't have to change back and forth. He eternally exists in all of those forms. All of the forms are eternal, and he simultaneously exists in all of those forms. So all of this is being said in that verse, Ye yatha mam prapadyante tans tathaiva bhajamyaham. Where Shri Krishna says, it's up to you. In what form do you want me to come to you? If you love me as Shiva, I will come to you in my almighty form as God Shiva. It's up to you. I have no personal preference. This one verse of the Gita brings together all the religions of the world. It makes the philosophy of the Gita universal. Can you close the door? Thanks. It's fine as long as it's closed. How does it make it universal? Because it means that everybody on this whole earth planet or anywhere in the universe who's worshipping God is worshipping Krishna. Whether they call him Krishna or not, Anantanam Rupaya, God has, Krishna has, uncountable forms and uncountable names. So whether they call him by Krishna or Govinda or Gopal or any other name in their own language, or they visualize him in any other form, if they are worshipping God, they are worshipping Krishna. So this is why I say there is no such thing as a Hindu God or a North Indian God or a South Indian God or a Christian God, or a Muslim God. There's just God, and that God is Krishna. This is one of the deep devotional philosophies of the Gita, which is just indicated. It's not like Krishna didn't describe it in tremendous detail, but that philosophy is there. It's imbued in that one shloka. And it makes sense. There could only be one God. If God is omnipresent and absolute, then how could there be more than one of Him? There can only be one. There's not room for two gods. But that God is unlimited, so He can appear in any form to anybody, anywhere on this earth planet. And the second meaning of this verse, or a practical application of that meaning, is that however you love God, He loves you the same way in return. However you surrender to Him, He loves you the same way in return. Bhajamyaham. Shri Krishna says, Main tumhari bhakti karta hun. Bhajami aham. I do your bhakti. When you surrender to me, I serve you. I love you. However you surrender to me, I love you the same way in return. And there are five main ways of surrendering to God, or loving God, you could say. When we talk of relationships, you can't have a relationship with formless God. That's out of the question. You can have a relationship with the personal form of God. So with Almighty God, with Paramatma, meaning Vishnu, Shiva, Durga, any of those Almighty forms, there's one style of relationship, which is called Shant Bhav. It's like a subject having admiration for his king or queen. Admiration, like a loving respect. Why only this one way of loving God? Because Almighty God is not revealing the power of divine love. Almighty God is established in His divine dignity, godliness. So He's going to behave like the king, or she's going to behave like the queen. Serious, but friendly. Loving, but totally reserved. Total 100% formality. Like if your father is a Supreme Court judge. So you go into the courtroom and you see him sitting there and you can admire, oh, my father is so powerful. Look at him. He's a Supreme Court judge. But that's in that scene, he's behaving with 100% formality. There's not even a touch of lovingness in his behavior. He may be friendly, but not playful or loving or charming. Your same father, when he comes home, then you can treat him like your father. In the court, you can't treat him as your father. Similarly, Almighty God just has that one way of relating to souls, just with the Shant Bhav, that He's the king and we're His subjects. So it's quite a distant relationship. Closer than that, much closer, are the other four Bhav, where you have much more freedom how you can interact with God. You can't really interact with the almighty forms of God. You can sit in their darbar, have their divine vision, enjoy their perfect divine bliss, which is always unlimited. But you can't have an interaction. That interaction happens in the leelas, which are only performed by Ram and Krishna. So with Ram and Krishna, you have, beyond the Shant Bhav, you have Dasya Bhav, which allows some interaction. Das means you get to serve them. So it's still not an extremely close relationship, but it's much closer than just being a subject in their kingdom. You can personally serve them. But a servant still maintains quite a degree of formality with his master. So if you want more closeness and less formality, you can adopt Sakya Bhav. Now you came very close. Sakya Bhav means loving God as a friend. Keeping in mind that He says, however you love me, I love you the same way in return. So if you think of me as your master, I'll treat you as a servant. If you think of me as a friend, then I treat you as a friend. Like the king treats his friend in public. He stops acting like the king when he's in private with his best friend. Similarly, Shri Krishna says, that's your option. You want to be my best friend? Then love me with those feelings. Dare to love him with those feelings. I say dare because we feel like, how can I love God like a best friend? He's God. So Sri Krishna says, forget that I'm God. In your meditation, when you're loving me, forget that I'm God. I'm yours. That's it. I'm your best friend, your sakha. If you want to be even closer than this, the fourth bhav is vatsalya bhav. That affords even more, you can say, almost right over God. Adhikar unke upar. Just like you have adhikar over your own kids, you tell them what to eat, what to wear. I mean, until a certain age. If you want to have God as your own child, love Krishna as your own child, and you can have that kind of relationship with Him. So close, so loving. And the ultimate relationship is called Madhurya Bhav, which encompasses all of the other relations. Madhurya Bhav means loving God as your priyatam, as your beloved. That's the closest relationship that you can have. So this is all indicated in this verse. These topics are actually further expounded and expanded on in the Bhagavatam. That's why we say where the Gita ends, the Bhagavatam begins. But we're covering the philosophy of the Gita, so we'll leave it at that. That however you love God, He loves you the same way in return. And there's one more important verse of this fourth chapter. Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshinah. I briefly mentioned this verse on the first day. It's the only verse in the Gita where Sri Krishna talks about the relationship between a guru and disciple. He talks about God-realized saints in many verses, in many chapters. But how is an ordinary soul supposed to relate to a God-realized saint, and what benefit are we supposed to get from them? He mentions that in this verse. He says that if you wish to know God, then you must surrender to a God-realized saint. This exact statement is found in different words in Shvetashvatara Upanishad, Mundaka Upanishad. Tad vijnanartham sagurumeva bhigachet samit pani shrotriyam brahmanishtham. If you want to know God, then surrender yourself to a God-realized saint. Shrotriya brahmanisht mahapurush. Mahapurush means a saint. Shrotriya means learned in the scriptures. And brahmanisht means having attained God. See, Ved and Gita said the same thing. Jnanina, having a knowledge of the scriptures. Tattva darshina, darshina, having seen the actual tattva, meaning God. That is the qualification of a saint. A saint has to have seen God, plain and simple. So find such a God-realized saint who has seen God and who has a total knowledge of the scriptures, and surrender to that saint. Pranipatena, Shri Krishna says. The word pat means to surrender, like physically showing your obeisance to the saint. Just physically doing pranam. That's pat. Then you have patena. Then you have pranipatena. That means from inside, you surrender your heart and mind to the saint. Not just a physical display of politeness, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with being polite, being respectful. But Sri Krishna is saying that that show of politeness doesn't result in receiving the saint's grace, because that's received internally. The saint can only grace you if you connect your heart with him. And that is done through surrender, faith, dedication to the saint. So he says, pranipatena pariprashnena. If you have questions, ask. But he didn't just say prashnena. Prashnena means just ask any old way. Pariprashnena means you have to be ready to receive and accept what the saint is going to tell you. It means if we ask a question, we have to do it with humbleness, which means we have to be... See, the qualification, we should stop ourselves. If we ever get the chance to meet a true saint and we have a question, before asking the question, we should ask ourselves, am I willing to accept the answer of the saint? Or do I already have an answer figured out in my own mind? So if I already have the answer, then I'm just doing prashnena. If I'm becoming humble and emptying out whatever previous knowledge I think I have, then when I ask, I'm doing pariprashnena. Then the saint can remove my confusion, otherwise not. And sevaya. Why serve the saint? Why do seva? Because the saint has to be able to grace you. And as I said, that grace is received according to the surrender of our heart. And whatever surrender you have initially to the saint is able to grace you that much. It's like an electrical connection. So if you improve the connection and the conductor, more electricity can flow more efficiently along that. So improving your surrender to the saint means you'll be able to receive more of the saint's grace. Like if there's a powerhouse, and that powerhouse has the potential to give power to anyone, but you have to connect the line, a proper conductor, to the powerhouse, then the energy will flow along it. So we have to connect our heart and mind to the saint, then the saint's grace will flow into our mind. So the saint doesn't just give us knowledge through words. The saint gives us an experience through his grace. It means that words can give you a theoretical understanding, but you need to actually experience that thing that you understand the theory of. So how do you experience that thing? Through the saint's grace. Spiritual experience comes through a God-realized saint's grace. So that's why we have to serve the saint to improve our surrender. Maybe we have 25% surrender. Okay, how to improve that? Do seva to the saint. That's why Sri Krishna says sevaya. Then the saint will be able to reveal that grace within your heart, and you will know God through that saint's grace. So this verse tells us not only the necessity of having a guru, that you can't find God without a guru, but also how we're supposed to think of the guru and behave towards the guru, and what do we have to do to receive the guru's grace. And in addition to that, this same verse tells us, what does the saint do for us if we are able to surrender to him? He gives us the true knowledge and he graces us with the actual experience of God. So all of that is there in these two very important verses of the fourth chapter. Most of the fifth chapter is in fact review of topics we've already covered in the first four. So with the few minutes we have remaining tonight, I'm just going to touch on a couple of the more important verses of the fifth chapter. In the beginning of the fifth chapter, Arjuna asks Krishna, what is better, karma sannyas or karma yoga? Remember, there's four kinds of karma described in the Gita. They're called karma, vikarma, karma yoga, and karma sannyas. So we already covered this part, that karma and vikarma keep a person in the world, because they're both done with worldly attachment. Good karma results in rebirth in this world. Bad karma results in rebirth in this world. But karma yoga does not, because that means doing good actions with the mind attached to God. So you attain God. And karma sannyas means renouncing the world, but keeping the mind attached in God, so you also attain God. So when Arjuna asked this question to Shri Krishna answered by saying, karma sannyasa karma yogascha nishreyasa karavubhau. Karma sannyasat. He says, first of all, Arjun, nishreyasa karavubhau. Both of them give nishreyas, which means God realization. Yet, sannyasat karma yogascha. Better than karma sannyas is karma yoga. Karma yogo vishishyate. Vishishyate, karma yoga is better than karma sannyas. Why? Two main reasons. For one, most people of the world, 99% of the world, would not take sannyas even if they were given the chance. Nobody wants to renounce the world. So for those people, how are they going to attach their mind to God? If they're not going to renounce the world and go somewhere isolated and keep their mind attached to God, what are they going to do? They have to do karma yoga, which means they have to live in the world and do all of their physical duties, but while doing that, keep their mind attached to God. So from that point of view, karma yoga is better than karma sannyas because it's more practical for the majority of the people. It is not better from a results point of view. Both karma yoga and karma sannyas give the exact same result. It is also better from one other point of view. What if someone imitates a karma yogi or someone imitates a karma sannyasi? What part will they be able to imitate? None of us can see inside another person's heart, so you can't imitate what someone's thinking. You can't imitate where is their mind attached. You can only imitate their physical actions. So if someone imitates a karma yogi, what will they be doing? Good karma. They may not have their mind attached to God, but at least they'll be doing good actions in the world. If someone imitates a karma sannyasi without attaching their mind to God, what are they doing? They'll be doing wrong actions. Because they ignored all of their worldly duties, and on top of that, they don't have their mind attached to God either. So they're doing vikarma. The one who imitates a karma sannyasi's physical actions will be doing vikarma. And the one who imitates a karma yogi's physical actions will be doing good karma. So from this point of view as well, karma yoga is better than karma sannyas. Which is why Krishna is telling Arjuna, you be an example. People will imitate you. So do the good action of following your duty, but do it while keeping your mind attached to me. There are a couple verses in the fifth chapter which tell about the divine state of God realization. Tad buddhayas tad atmanas tan nishthas tat parayana. What is God realization like? That saint who has become God realized, his mind has become one with God and can never be separated. It's like if you have a clear wax, but you melt it so it becomes liquefied and then you add some color into that. Now when it cools, the color and the wax have become one. The wax has become impregnated with the color and now the two can never be separated. Similarly, the saint's mind has become one with God. Tad buddhaya. Tadatmana, his whole being is one with God. Tannishtha, same thing. He's fully impregnated with divine bliss and divine knowledge. Tatparayana, he loves only God. His only relationship is with God. Therefore, lipyatena sapapena padmapatramivambhasa. This verse says, like the lily pad, like we have over here in America, or the padma, the lotus flower. The lotus plant is like a lily in that it's totally waterproof. It sits on the water, and water can sit on it, but it never gets wet. It's always dry. Similarly, the saint is in the world, but remains untouched by punya or pap. Even though the saint is physically active in the world, yet he remains aloof from both good and bad actions. This verse refers only to pap. Lipyate nasa papena. But pap means pap and punya. Why, you say? Because both pap and punya are binding. Punya means good actions done with a worldly reward as your hope, as why you're doing. What's your motivation for the good action? To get a reward, a karmic reward in this life, the next life, in swarg. That's punya. So that punya is also binding because you have to be reborn in order to receive that punya. So both punya and pap, obviously pap is binding, but sometimes the word pap is used for both pap and punya. It means any binding action, whether it's good or bad. So lipyate nasa papena means neither pap or punya can touch the saint. He's beyond. Why? Because his mind is in God. His mind is absorbed in divine bliss. So he has no selfish motivation for doing anything. In fact, the saint can never perform any karma ever again. Bichari. He lost his ability to perform karma. Nothing he does will ever count. Why? Because his mind is in God. Any action you perform with your mind in God is, it doesn't give any mayic fruit, so it's not binding. That's why Shri Krishna says, Mam ekam sharanam vraja, aham tvam sarva pape bhyo mokshayishyami. Arjun, if you completely surrender to me, then I free you from all of your pap, which means all of your pap and punya, because punya is also binding. We have an unlimited stock of past pap and punya, which is our karmic bondage. In Vedas, it says, Bhidyate hridayagranthish chidyante sarvasanshraya chiyante chasya karmani tasmin drishte paravare. Mundaka Upanishad. Tasmin drishte paravare. Remember, param drishtva nivartate from the Gita. When you see God, then all of your desires are finished because you receive the ultimate object of your desire, perfect happiness. So tasmin drishtva nivartate. Veda also says, when you see God, what happens? Bhidyate hridaya granthi. The knot of mayic ignorance in your heart is khola jaya. It's opened and it's finished forever. Bhidyante sarva sanshrayaha. All of your doubts are finished forever. Chiyante chasya karmani. All of your past karma, chiyante. It's destroyed, burnt, finished. Another verse from Mundaka Upanishad says, Yada pashyate rukmavarnam Kartaramisham Purusham Brahma Yonim Tada Vidvan Punya Pape Vidhuya Niranjana Paramam Samya Mupaiti. Yada Pashyate. Yada means when. Pashyate, he sees. When he sees God, then what happens? He is freed. Vidhuya means washed away. What's washed away? Punya pape vidhuya. All of his past punya and pap is washed away, and he's liberated and he becomes like God. Samya mupaiti. He becomes just like God. Like Brahma Sutra says, Bhoga matra samya lingaccha. How do you become like God? In terms of what you experience. How much bliss and how much knowledge you have? The same what God has. It's not like he says, okay, I have unlimited anand in my possession, but you're just a little soul, so here, have a little bit of anand. Have a little bit of knowledge. No, he gives you the whole thing. But there's one thing he doesn't give according to Brahma Sutra. Jagad vyapar varjam. He never gives the duty of creating, maintaining, or destroying the universe to a soul. He does that himself. Souls just have one thing to do after God realization, enjoying divine bliss. Or sometimes they may come on the earth planet in the form of a saint and help the other souls, but they're never involved in srishti. God does that himself. So a soul doesn't become God, but samya mupayiti lagbhag ek ho jate hain. He becomes almost the same as God. Gita also says, na kartritvam na karmani lokasya srijati prabhu. Shri Krishna says, I don't perform the karmas of the souls. They do that. I give them the power to perform karma, but they have their own free will. So they are responsible for their actions. I simply keep track and I give the consequences. Na karma phala sanyogam swabhavastu pravartate. The souls perform actions according to their own nature, according to their own desires, and I merely give the consequences. Like water is flowing, anyone can come and use it. Do you use it for something good, like cooking, cleaning, drinking? Or do you use it for something bad, like drowning another person in it? It's up to you. It's not the water's fault if you misuse it. You can't blame the river if you use it to commit a sin. Similarly, we can't blame God if we use His God-given power, which gives life to our soul, mind, and senses and body. If we use that power to perform bad actions, we can't blame Him for that, which is why we receive the consequences of our actions. If God were responsible for our actions, then He should suffer the consequences or forgive Himself. But why should we get the consequences of his actions? So he says that in the Gita. And he also says, Agyanena vritam jnanam tena muhyanti jantava. All the souls who aren't God realized, they're covered in maya. And that maya causes an ignorance. And this is what keeps the souls from knowing who they are. Bhagavatam also says, Bhayam dvitiya bhinivesatasya dishadapetasya viparyayo smriti. Souls have been eternally turned away from God. It never happened, but we are turned away from God. Since when? Since eternity. So what happens since we're turned away from God? Because we're turned away from God, Maya has covered us. When did Maya cover us? Meaning, when did we become bound by Maya? When did it happen? Well, it would have had to happen when we turned away from God. Because had we been facing God, Maya could have no effect on us. Maya itself can't stand in front of God, just like darkness can't stand in front of the sun. If the sun is there shining, darkness cannot be there. Similarly, if God is there, Maya cannot be there. So if a soul is surrendered to God, if a soul is turned towards God, sunmukh, then Maya cannot have that soul under the bondage. So, when did Maya put us under its bondage? It must have happened at that time when we turned away from God. When we turned away from God, Maya put us under bondage. So when did we turn away from God? It never happened. We've eternally been turned away from God. Had we ever been turned towards God, it's impossible to turn away and get caught by Maya. God realization is forever. Sada pashyanti surayah tad vishno paramam padam. Ved says, once you get God realized, you never become un-God realized. It's forever. So had we ever been with God, turn towards God, we could never turn away from God and Maya could never cover us. So it means that if we're under the bondage of Maya today, we have had to have been under the bondage of Maya since eternity. It could have never happened to us. It's always been that way. So we have, according to this, logically, it means we've been turned away from God since eternity. Therefore, Maya has had us under its bondage since eternity. And the result of this Mayic bondage is that it makes us forget who we are. We start believing we're the body, and we forget that our true identity is the soul. And since we believe we're the body, well, the body is made of Maya, and the body belongs to the world, which is also made of Maya, so it means we start thinking we belong to this world. And if we belong to the world, then our happiness must be in this world. It means I'm going to find happiness from the things or the achievements or the people of this world. Why? Because I belong to the world, so my happiness has to be in this world. Why? Because I'm the body, and the body belongs to the world. So this is how we keep multiplying our worldly attachments. The root cause of that is that we identify with our physical body. So then we seek happiness in all the worldly things, and that multiplies our worldly attachments. Even if we get the happiness, that only multiplies our worldly attachments and doesn't put an end to our desires, as we already learned in the second chapter. Our desires for the world just go on growing. So this is our state since eternity. Believing we're the body and seeking happiness from this world and just multiplying our worldly desires and attachments. And because of that, we get born again and again in this world. And also due to our worldly desires and attachments, we're always performing more binding actions. Any action done with a worldly desire is going to bind you. So this is our state since eternity. It never happened. It's always been like that. So how to undo this? How to fix our situation? Only one thing to do. Become sanmukh. Turn towards God. Just by turning towards God, Maya will go away. So how will you turn towards God? If you start thinking you're the soul, you'll turn towards God automatically. Because the soul is divine, so it makes sense that the soul could not be satisfied with physical pleasures of the world. Mayic pleasures cannot satisfy the divine soul. So only God is divine, like your soul. So only God's happiness could satisfy your soul. So if you just remember this one fact, the fact that Krishna taught Arjun right away when he started talking, you are the soul, not the body. If you remember that, then you can't help but turn towards God. But turning towards God means mentally surrendering to God in your heart. It doesn't mean physically leaving the world, because God is not more in the jungle than he is in the world. He's just as much in the world as he is in the jungle. You just have to turn your mind towards him. So as soon as you turn towards him, Ved says, iti vita shoka. Jushtam yada pashyatyanyamisha masya mahimana vitish iti vita shoka. Our Vedas say the moment you turn towards God, jushtam yada, jushtam, you turn towards him. When you do that, yada pashyati. Again, the same thing. You see him. He appears before you. And then what happens? All your troubles are finished. Why? Because Maya is gone. And Maya is the source of all of our troubles. When Maya is gone, then anger is gone, jealousy is gone, hatred is gone. Everything that troubles us is gone. And then we receive God's bliss and God's knowledge. And we keep that divine state forever. Whether we're living in the world or whether we go to the divine world, we keep that same divine state. So this brings us to the end of the fifth chapter. And tomorrow will be the final chapter of this segment of these speeches, where I'll cover the topics of the sixth chapter. One of those topics is meditation. There are a couple other topics I'll address as well. But one of the most important topics of this sixth chapter is how to meditate on God. So that will be the focus for tomorrow.